Svapavam eke kava yoga rabbi kalam tatanye parimuyamanaha devasyaisha mahima tu loke yene dangvam yate brahma chakram. Some learned scholars say that the laws of material nature are the cause of existence. And others say that time is, but actually all these authorities are thoroughly bewildered. Rather, everything that exists in this world is simply the glory of the effulgent Supreme Lord, who causes the living beings to wander in the wheel of Brahman. This chapter is going to again describe the qualities of the Supreme Person. Here, we're referring back to the very first discussion at the beginning of the first chapter, where the sages were puzzling over the question of what actually is Brahman, what is the cause of everything, the ultimate truth. And just for the sake of listing the alternatives, you know, we have a dilemma. We don't know what reality is. So let us just survey what people in the past have proposed, suggested as ultimate causes. And they mentioned time, the material elements, the individual nature of everything, and just chance, and so on. None of those sages seriously believed that any of these theories. They were Brahmavadis. They were looking for something higher. They were not materialists or fools. But they were logically or rationally making a survey. Here are all the alternatives. Here's all the theories of the past. So now they're referring back to that. Some people say that Svabhava is the cause of existence. Some say that time is. And there were four or five other causes mentioned back in the first chapter. Parimuyamanaha. But now, after hearing five chapters of the Upanishad, it's very obvious that these people are bewildered. They don't know anything about the absolute truth, which is very definitely the one cause of all existence. It's very important to recognize that everything, the reality is unified. There is one cause from which everything comes. Janmani Asya Yataha. The Vedanta Sutra, which is Vyasadeva's explanation of the Upanishads, his summarization of the essential message of the Upanishads. He starts off saying, Atato Bhavigyasa. The purpose of this knowledge is inquiry into what is the supreme truth. And what is supreme truth? If you were to stop people in the street and ask them what the supreme truth is, they would say, oh, money is, food is, happiness, security, you know, so on. Health is the supreme truth. People would give various answers. But Vyasadeva is giving the definitive Shastric answer. The perfect answer. And that is the absolute truth is that one ultimate reality from which the creation of everything comes. That same one reality is the maintainer of everything. And we're all concerned about destruction. We have two concerns: to acquire things and to protect them from being destroyed. A young man wants to acquire a family. And then as he gets older, he's more concerned with the possibility of his family being destroyed. He makes a lot of money so he can build a strong house. Then he buys a large life insurance policy in case he's destroyed. And so on. He becomes more and more concerned with protection of what he has. So we're all so much worried about destruction. Well, if we understand, everything that is destroyed goes back into that absolute truth. The absolute truth is the agent of destruction. Nobody can destroy you but the absolute truth. And the soul is never destroyed. So understanding the absolute truth as the creator, maintainer, and destroyer of everything is the basis of real knowledge. And this is the essential teaching of the Upanishads. We don't have to read the Upanishads because we have the essence of the essence. Yasmin vigyate sarva eva vigyato bhavati, as stated in the Mundaka Upanishad. Knowing this truth, everything else is automatically known. So the devotees of Krishna, who know Krishna, the personality of Godhead, in his intimate aspect, they automatically appreciate the absolute truth as the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. They don't have to separately study it. By studying Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita, the essential knowledge of all the Upanishads is already gained. We don't have to study them separately. But here we are, sitting and studying one of the Upanishads. We can get some additional insight this way. The Upanishads are not teaching us about the personal glories of the Lord. He's not, at least the Upanishad, the basic Upanishads are not naming him. Not naming him properly. They're calling him Rudra or something else. Or they're avoiding any personal description and just describing his relationship to the material world as the Supersoul, as the Creator, and so on. But these are important things to learn for a conditioned soul. The conditioned souls can appreciate the transcendental personality of God and his inconceivable pastimes. They have to become liberated first. And by understanding what God is, how that same Supreme Person is the absolute truth, the Supreme Controller, the Creator, one can develop the proper appreciation, the proper reverence, and become renounced and transcend material illusion. That's the purpose of the Upanishadic teachings. They give this process of jnana, by which one can become purified of material attachment and approach liberation. Liberation is the qualification for devotional service. Bhakti includes jnana automatically. You don't have to cultivate jnana separately. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita. Just by properly engaging in Bhakti Yoga, not sentimental devotion, but proper devotional service, following proper guidance, scientific devotional service. Just by that process, Jana Yadyashu Vayanagyam Gyanam Cha Yadavaitukam. Causelessly, without any separate endeavor, knowledge and renunciation automatically develop for one who is properly cultivating Bhakti Yoga. So, not that we don't need them, but we don't need to work for them separately.
The reference for that verse?
This is Sutta Goswami speaking in the second chapter of the first canto, the second chapter of the Bhagavatam. That's verse number 7. 127. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita. 127. Okay. We can read the next verse.
Yenavitam nityamidam sarvam yak kala kalo buddhi sarva vidya tene shitam karma vivarta teha vidvyavyate jo nilakani chintyam.
He always pervades the entire world. He is the omniscient regulator of time, which regulates everything. He possesses all transcendental qualities and is the expert authority in all fields of knowledge. He supervises the evolution of karma with its manifestations of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Thus, one should meditate upon him. So here is summarized, this is not new information, sort of a summary of what's been presented throughout. These are the qualities of the Supreme in relationship to the material world. To know anything about the Supreme Person is purifying, to have any contact with him. Even as the regulator, in his official capacity as the regulator of this universe, it's not the most personal or intimate way to approach him. But any approach to him will uplift one, will liberate one. So, there are some details here. His different glories, his different qualities as the creator and maintainer. Yena avritam nityam. Everything is covered by him, always. He's within everything as the super soul. Every living being is accompanied by him in the heart, and even every atom has him in the center. Prabhupada said Krishna is the neutron in every atom. The neutron is understood as the particle that holds the protons and electrons apart, so they don't just crash into each other and annihilate everything. He's inside everything, every person, everything, down to the last atom. Nothing acts, nothing functions without his personal intervention. And he's outside of everything also. He's beyond. Although nothing in the material world is separate from him, it doesn't mean that he's the material world and nothing else. His existence goes much beyond the material world. The material existence is just a minute fraction, insignificant fraction of Krishna's glories. Yeah, he's omniscient, all-knowing. And then another word in the same line, sarva-vidyaha, which also means knowing everything, but that's understood according to the commentaries, that he's expert in all kinds of scientific and artistic knowledge. He knows all fields of knowledge. There's nobody who's an expert in everything, except for Krishna, except for God. Time is the ruler of everyone. Everyone has to fear time. We can pretend to ignore time. The time is, then we become more and more fearful. If we don't heed time, then we're fools. And then we will be cut down in our foolishness. Everybody else is subject to time, but the Supreme Person, including all the demigods, all the sages, up to Brahma, he has his ultimate time also. Death ultimately comes to him also. Even in the beginning of creation, Brahma was controlled by time. He couldn't just begin and create. He had to take his time. He had to meditate for 1,000 years. This wasn't his choice. It was hard work for him. He was bewildered. He was frustrated. He wanted to get to work. He was being pushed by the mode of passion. I have a universe to create here, and I'm sitting here in this lotus flower doing nothing. I don't know where to begin. Yes?
He said he did it for 1,000 years to meditate. What kind of years? I thought you were in this time.
Well, not his years. Thousand years. I don't know which way. Earth years. It does say 1,000 years. Celestial, it does say that. Yeah, so 1,000 years in the demigods, which are just, blink of the eye for him anyway. But he wasn't able to do what he wanted, when he wanted. He was controlled by time. Even Brahma. And time itself is controlled by that Supreme Person. That's his independence. And that's how much he's the controller of everything else. All the great controllers are controlled by time, but time is controlled by the Supreme Person. Guni, he's the possessor of all qualities. That means all the material qualities, the three modes of nature, all the material qualities, and all his own spiritual qualities also. The word guni, someone who has qualities, that means someone who has good qualities, a person who is virtuous, who has distinctive qualities. But he's the most distinctive, the most virtuous person. Regulated by him, karma, the laws of nature, act themselves out. And especially the creation evolves naturally under his superintendence. The materialistic philosophers in Vedic culture will say, no. Prakriti, Pradhan, is the creator. And we'll say, okay, you're correct. Everything evolves from Prakriti. And Maya is not only the inert ingredient, she's also the intelligence. She has her two aspects, active aspect and the inert aspect. She supplies the ingredients, but she also supplies the intelligence for creation. But she is only a maidservant of the Supreme Person who glances on her and empowers her and dictates to her what to do. The materialists may say, they're saying now, they're teaching, they taught us when we went to school, that creation is an evolution of the material elements. That's all. That's all you need to know. You know. When you're 14, 15 years old, you're sent to chemistry class. When you're 16 years old, you're sent to physics class, your biology class. You learn these three sciences, you'll understand creation. That's all there is to know. That is reality. And they come combine. You know, in the sun are all these different elements. All over the universe are scattered. And somehow they bounce around and combine and things happen. DNA happens. Amoebas happen. Monkeys happen. Men happen. And the world evolves. By natural combination. Here it's pointed out, okay, that may be true. The evolution of the world is occurs very naturally. It can be explained mechanically in so many ways. There are so many laws of nature that you can discover. But who legislates those laws? That's the Supreme Person. Why does uranium have 98 electrons, you know, in certain orbits? Because Lord Narayan decided. That's how I'll build uranium atoms. Teneshitam, regulated by him, the laws of karma act themselves out, and the different elements of creation evolve. And one should meditate upon this. Chintyam, this should be meditated on. This is the proper object of spiritual development. By meditating on the Lord as the creator, we can develop proper appreciation for the Supreme Person. That's why the Bhagavatam also teaches this, the process of creation in the second, especially in the second and third cantos. In some detail, devotees should meditate on these things. Okay? Next verse. Verse 3. Tat karma kritva vidivarta bhuyaha tatvasya tatvena samedya yogam. Ekena dvavyam tribir ashta birva kalena chaivatma gunaischa sukshmaihi. Having done the basic work of creation, the Lord then turned from that to combining each of the elements one with another. He brought the living beings into contact with these elements, sometimes with only one of them, sometimes with two, sometimes three, and sometimes all eight. He also brought the jivas into contact with the subtle qualities of the mind. There's different aspects of creation. creation. It begins with Lord Mahavishnu glancing at Prakriti. You can study in the Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita how this happens. Prakriti is originally dormant. The modes of nature are completely balanced before Mahavishnu glances at her. His glance agitates her, and the modes are pushed out of balance. First, the mode of goodness becomes predominant, and then the mode of passion, then the mode of ignorance, and then the complex evolution, complex permutations of the modes evolves, and the different elements come out of that. The first phase, then, is the Lord glancing at Maya and the elements evolving out. But then, the elements are all there, lined up and ready to go. And each of them has a presiding demigod, 10 demigods ruling each of the elements from Mahatattva down to earth. But they can't do anything. The elements can't combine with each other. And without combining, nothing visible or perceivable or functional can manifest in this world. Just piles of different atoms doesn't make a universe. They have to combine with each other. And they tried. They couldn't. The demigods couldn't make, they couldn't work together, and they couldn't make the different atoms combine. Nothing happened. They went back to Mahavishnu and prayed to him, "We need your help." And he agreed. He entered each of the elements. And Mahavishnu personally made the different atoms combine with each other. It's a process called Panchikarana. There are five different elements, five gross elements. Mahavishnu personally took the atoms and mixed them up. He cut each pile of atoms in half and then took away. So you have to make a diagram here.
You have five different kinds of atoms like this. This is the stop of all the earth atoms in the universe. You take out half of them and distribute them to the other four elements. You cut up this 50%, so 25, each one is probably 100%. Right here. Send 12.5% of the earth atoms to be mixed up with each of the other atoms. And because you're going to take out half of each of the other atoms, there's going to be room for a 12% contribution, for 50% to be added from elsewhere. 4 times 12.5 is 50%. So by that process of taking out these little slices, percentages, and sending them to be mixed up with each of the other four elements. And then in these four places, you get a small 12.5% of his earth, water, air, fire, ether. Now you've got what's supposed to be, what we think is earth, is actually 50% earth mixed up with 12.5% of each of the other kinds of atoms. Then you've got something that can be worked with. That
mixing up, the panchikarana, or making of five, dividing up and splitting among five parts, that was done by Mahavishnu himself. That's described in the Vishnu Purana. Now that each element, we're not cutting up the atoms. This is the pile of atoms and taking out a percentage of the atoms and sending them to be mixed up with the other atoms. Now that the atoms are mixed, they can combine. Earth can combine with water because the Mahavishnu has mixed in water with the earth atoms. Now they can make contact with the water and interact, and with each of the other elements. The demigods are able to take this modified version of the material elements and make them combine and act together. That's what's being described in this verse. Tatvasya tatvena sameti yogam. He brought... He turned from the first stage of creation to the work of combining each of the elements one with another. And then he brought the living beings in contact with these elements. That was done by the agency of Brahma, who who created the bodies of the living entities. Some bodies, like the bodies of human beings on the earth, are combinations of all the elements. But on higher planets, there are just subtle bodies. The demigods live in mental bodies. They don't have earth, water, fire. They just have some more subtle elements. And if you live on Lord Shiva's planet, you'll have a body of just false ego, just one element. So it depends on what level, what planet you take your body on. That determines how many elements, whether you have all the gross elements or just the more subtle elements composing your body. And the Lord is also responsible not only for connecting up the jivas with their physical bodies, but connecting them with their subtle mind and all its qualities. We have problems not only with our bodies, but with our minds. Our minds are supposed to facilitate our enjoyment as well, but they usually cause us more trouble than the body. Okay.
Arabhya karmani gunna vitani bhavamstra sarva vidyo jayidya tesham abhave kritta karma nashaha karmakshaye yati satapatonyaha.
Okay, we're shifting for one verse to focusing on the jiva, conditioned soul. The jiva involves himself in activities mixed with various material qualities. If he dovetails his activities for higher purposes, however, the material contamination of his work will diminish to nil. I think I spelled that word wrong. Then, when his karmic reactions have been depleted, he will leave this world. Indeed, the jiva is in reality distinct from matter. Basic understanding of who the jiva is. He's ultimately separate from matter, but he's got himself caught up, entangled in matter. He doesn't belong there, but he's gotten himself stuck. Arabhya. Arab means to intentionally start something. The word Arab strongly suggests an endeavor, an intentional attempt. You know, when somebody intentionally starts something, that's Arabhya. Not when he falls off a cliff or just without any intention does something. When he knows what he's doing and he makes an effort to do something, that's called Arabhya, starting an endeavor. The living entity starts his own entanglement in this world. It's his own choice. Nobody pushed him into it. It didn't happen accidentally. It happened by his own misuse of his free will. And as a consequence, he comes into contact with all kinds of material conditions. Conditions in the sense of situations, but especially conditions in the sense of limitations. Material life means restriction, limitation. The basic, noticeable, prominent feature of material life is not how much you can do what you want and enjoy, but how little you can. You know, the big lesson of material life is that this is not the right way to live, because in material life you can't usually do what you want. You're not free, you're not happy, you're confused, miserable, and restricted. Why? Well, that's the big question. But the answer is because you've disconnected yourself from the basis of your existence, from the Supreme Person. But entering, willingly having separated oneself from the Supreme Person, a jiva soul enters into this life of entanglement and restriction. But the third line says there is hope. There are ways out of the entanglement. Krita karma nasha. One can dovetail his activities for higher purposes. Vinayojayate. It is not easy to suddenly break free from illusion, because we think it's reality. We think we don't have an alternative. Or even if we hear of an alternative, we're not attracted to it. We're very attracted to stay in our illusion. So that we can't just break out of it in most cases. A very rare soul can. So we have to gradually get gently pulled out of illusion. We don't want to be yanked out. Just like we have a bad tooth and our friend offers, or we have a boil and our friend offers to come and break the boil with a knife, a needle. And even though we're in agony, we're getting gradually poisoned in our body, we refuse. You're not going to stick me with that. I'm not going to let you do that. Even though it's the best thing for us, we refuse. So like that, the great souls are offering to lance our boil for us, to pull us out immediately out of illusion, but we don't want it. We say, oh, isn't there some gradual process? Can I put some medicine on the boil, or some lotion or something, or maybe I can squeeze it and pinch it? We're asking for a gradual process, so that's provided. Okay, you can stay in illusion, you like to suffer, but the Vedic authorities are providing you all different ways to dovetail your propensities. So you can at least gradually become purified if you're not willing to get the boil pierced all at once. And someone who does dovetail through proper Vedic sacrifice, a gradual cultivation of self-realization, he can become purified. If he dovetails his activity for higher purposes, the material contamination of his work will gradually diminish to nothing. And when you finally have no more karmic reactions, then you can leave this world, then you're free. Even in pure devotion, when practicing pure devotional service, we're also dovetailing. We know all we have to do is chant Hare Krishna and serve Srila Prabhupada. But that's not hard, easy to do. We chant our 16 rounds, but we don't listen to them. We don't chant them properly. Therefore, we don't experience the full result. We're committing offenses against the holy names, offenses against Vaishnavas, and offenses against Krishna. And therefore, we don't have a full taste of chanting. The opportunity is there to immediately surrender, but we're hesitating. So therefore, we also have to dovetail. We're working for Krishna. We're trying to be useful to Krishna. That is dovetailing, doing various practical activities. Of course, preaching is transcendental. But that, in a sense, is also dovetailing. Yes, preaching is the highest activity. But if we were chanting the Hare Krishna Mahamantra without any offenses, we'd be much better preachers. Right now, we're mediocre preachers because we're not chanting purely. So we're given the opportunity to dovetail, to do something for Krishna, to do some work, even though we're not qualified yet. We haven't surrendered fully yet, and therefore we're still wanting to suffer in this material world. We're still holding on to our material attachments. We're also, while engaged in the practice of pure devotional service, gradually giving up our attachments. That's the Lord's mercy. He's patient. He can give us some time. And when gradually our prarabdha karma, our tendencies, prarabdha karma manifests, that's our the past karma that has already manifested in concrete form in this life, especially in the form of the body that we're living in. That body imposes certain limitations. You know, I have a certain brain that can only think, you know, in a certain, you know, it doesn't have infinite intelligence or infinite agility, and neither does my physical body. You know, body is not getting younger, it's getting older. So I have my very definite limitations. And that body is going to be with me throughout the course of this life. That's Prabhupada Karman. And I have my subtle body also, which I've been dragging around for many lifetimes. And that's not changing so fast. This is my Prabhupada Karman, my manifest concrete karma. I have to tolerate that and live with it as long as it's with me. When I've used it up, this body will eventually get used up. Even my subtle body is getting used up, dissolved by the process of pure devotional service. When I finally can shake both of those off, then I'm free. But we have to be patient. It takes time. Even if we're not creating any new karma, it takes time to use up our old karma. There's a point made by Rama Ramanujacharya that if Krishna wants, he can eliminate our prarabdha karma, our past karma, immediately. He can liberate us. Even while we're in this body, he can separate us from it. We can become jivanmukta even while living in the body and have no more attachment. If he chooses, that's his choice. He can make us continue for several years with our subtle attachments, or he can show special mercy and immediately liberate us. That's up to him. There's no fixed time of how long it's going to take to attain final liberation. That's up to Krishna in each individual case. Because Krishna changes his mind according to how we interact with him. We can encourage Krishna to change his mind. Right, we can change our attitude and Krishna will be glad to change his. Yeah, he's not on a fixed schedule. That's our free will. Hardly anything we can change, but we can change our own attitude. And when we do, when we make a real change in our own attitude, just like the chapter in the second canto called Devotional Service, the Change in Heart. When your heart changes, that's what really changes your life. And that's what changes Krishna's attitude. When Krishna sees, especially, when Krishna notes that his devotee is seriously trying to hear about him, then he takes notice and he starts changing his attitude toward the devotee. When the devotee becomes serious about hearing, most essential process for that reason, because that's what attracts Krishna's attention. All other services are based on the strength of hearing. You can't do useful service for Krishna unless you have a taste for hearing and chanting, and hearing comes first. That's why Siddha Goswami is emphasizing this process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, because that attracts Krishna's attention and he wants to reciprocate with the devotee who is trying, is making an attempt to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. That's why it's important to devotees to come to Bhagavatam class, sit down with the other devotees and hear. What else do we have to do that's more important? Because it's boring. Basically, because it's boring. Well, Vishwanatha Chakravarti explains there's two kinds of cultivation of Bhajana Kriya. Two kinds of taste. When he starts to develop taste, the immature stage of that taste is that he only likes it when it's attractive. When the kirtan is done artistically, when the prasadam is well prepared, when the speaker is expert, then he's attracted only. That's less mature. That's not real attraction. That's conditional attraction. You're attracted to the opulence and not to the essence. One who has a real taste for Bhagavatam doesn't care how it's dressed up, who's speaking. Unless he's speaking complete nonsense, in which case he shouldn't be sitting on the seat. If he's saying anything that's based on Bhagavatam, it should be supremely attractive to one who has a real taste. just to hear, you know, repeated what was stated by these great persons is attractive enough, no matter whether it's explained expertly or not, or entertainingly or not. What do I have the traction? When he hears anything from the Bhagavatam, he's immediately enlivened. Even if it comes out of the mouth of a fool. There's also a regulative principle. We shouldn't chant around only when we feel like it. Only on those days when we feel like chanting 16 rounds. We took a vow to chant 16 rounds every day. And that's the way we can develop a taste for. That's a way we eventually will not be able to live without chanting, because we learned how to accept it as a regulation. So also we should accept it as a sublime duty to hear the Bhagavatam daily in the association of the devotees. Maybe some devotees can carry on their spiritual life without that. They can find some other source of strength. But certainly the community of devotees can't have any strength if the devotees don't come together. When are we going to come together? We'll have a business meeting every day. Or we'll only come together for feasts, for wedding feasts. And, you know, the other time you don't see any but Muslim devotees. The Bhagavatam class is the time. Mangalachi and Bhagavatam class, Guru Puja, these are the times when the devotees should see each other. Otherwise, there is no community. And there are other reasons. Okay, we have verse 5 here. No, there are reasons? No. Verse 5.
Adiksa samyoga nimitta hetu parastvikalad akalopi drishtaha tam vishvarupam bhavabhutam idyam devam svachittam svachittastamupasya purvam.
First, one should begin worshipping the effulgent Lord who is sitting in one's own heart. He is the origin of all, the cause of Maya, who is the immediate cause of the permutations of matter. Scripture tells us that he transcends the three phases of time and has no material parts. The universe is his body. He is the most worshipable foundation of existence. The Lord is the cause of Samyoga. Samyoga, in the translation, means the combinations of the elements of nature. He's the nimitta hetu. Of the nimitta, he's the hetu. Of the immediate cause of the combination of the elements, that's Maya. He's the ultimate cause. She's not independent. Previous verse described how he's the regulator of time. Well, he's also the cause of the cause, the cause of Maya, who is the cause of everything manifest. But another way to understand the meaning of this cause, the immediate cause, the cause of combination, that he is this, in the sense that he combines the jivas with these two energies, vidya and avidya. By combining them with avidya, with illusion, he creates their material life. Because they wanted it. He's simply giving them what they want. They want separated life without him. Okay, here is illusion. You can't be separated from me in reality, but I'll hide and pretend not to be here. And you can pretend to be the creators and enjoyers under illusion. And I'll provide the power of illusion over you to facilitate that. But he also provides vidya, the power of enlightenment, for those living entities who have had enough illusion and want to become free from it. So he's the cause of the connection of the jivas with these two energies of illusion and enlightenment. He's the cause of all causes. And he can be the cause of all causes. He's qualified, capable of being that, because he's beyond the three phases of time. Time doesn't control him. Time controls everything else, but he's free. That means he has no birth and no death. And he's not under anybody else's control. But he's Drishta. It's not that he's totally unknowable, unseeable. the devotees can see him. He reveals himself to the devotees with him whom he is pleased. He's Bhava Bhuta, the origin of all existence, material existence, and the essence of everything that exists is him. He's Idya, which means worshipable. Every person, every living being, should worship that Supreme Person. He's Deva, in the last line. He shines with all transcendental qualities. And he's present in everybody's own heart. So therefore, he's not hard to find. You don't have to look very far to locate him. For all these reasons, Rang Ramanuja says, the effort of realizing him is worth the trouble. Because by worshipping him, one will become liberated. Okay, that's it for us. We'll look at one more verse today.
Savriksha kala kriti bi paronyo yasvat papancham parivartate yam dharma vaham papanudam bhagisham yatvatmastam abritam vishwadama.
He is free from the conditions of living species like trees and of time. That means he's not like a living being, like a tree. A living being, a tree or any other living being, has certain limitations and is subject to having to pass through different phases of life. He isn't limited and controlled in that way. He's not like a tree or any other living species. And he's also free from the conditions of time. From him the creation expands. He is the initiator of religion, the destroyer of sin, the master of all opulences, the shelter of the universe. Knowing him in one's heart, one becomes immortal. So the material world is very often compared to a tree, just like in the Bhagavad Gita, beginning of the 15th chapter. Urdhva mulam adakshakam. Ashvatam Pahmurnavidyam. It is said that there is an imperishable banyan tree that has its roots upward and its branches down. That's the material world, is that banyan tree. Why tree? The word tree, vriksha, comes from the verb vrich, which means to cut. A tree can stand for a long time and he may be very upright and proud of his height, but anybody can easily cut him down. Anybody with a sharp axe. The living entity, the whole material existence, is subject to being cut down. It's temporary. It has its end. Everything in the material world has its end. But he's free from that material condition of being subject to an end. He's Ananta, Lord Ananta, the Lord who has no end. No connection with time, no connection with any material form. But everything evolving in time, all visible forms in this world come from him. And periodically are wound up in him again. Parivartate, that means go around in a circle. Rotate, like the earth, like the sun around the earth. Rotating. The whole existence is rotating around him. Periodically coming out of him and going back into him. Why should one know him? Because he's Dharmavaham. He's the person who inspires everyone to act religiously, to properly fulfill his function in life. He initiates pious activities which are conducive to realizing him. For those who want to act piously, he gives them the inspiration and the guidance. Those who want to act hellishly, he gives them the inspiration to go to hell. That's his compassion. He gives everybody what they want. It's this sinful activity, it's sinful mentality, that prevents one from developing real transcendental knowledge. That's our obstacle in this world. Kama isha, krodha isha. Lust and anger. Unlawful sinful activity and desires cover us in the lower modes, so we cannot make contact with this vidya shakti, this enlightenment energy of the Lord. We become barbarians because we want to behave sinfully, because we want to be unruly. We can't remain members of Vedic culture, just like the four sons of Yayati, the four sons who refused to accept his old age. Only Yadu accepted. The other four sons each refused. And he cursed them. You'll become outcasts. And they became the founders of the four major nationalities outside of Vedic culture. The Turks, the Greeks. Yayati, who was it trying to curse them? Anyway, he got cursed to become an old man. It's a very famous story, I don't remember the details. Anyway, he was cursed to become an old man. Daughter of Shukracharya. Devayani was the daughter of Shukracharya and married King Yayati. Anyway, he angered his father-in-law and got cursed to become old. And he asked, he had five sons, he asked each of them, "You please take my old age so I can have my youth back. You take the old age." And they all refused except for Yadu. He accepted. So Yadu got his blessings and became founder of the Yadu dynasty. The other four sons were cursed, and they had to leave India, and they became barbarians. Most of the barbarians in the world descend from them. The barbarian means those who don't want to follow any Vedic principles. They want to be unruly. But that means you cannot have spiritual knowledge. It means you have no access to Vedic knowledge, no access to the enlightenment energy of the Lord. Okay, any questions? Okay, we'll stop here. Okay, thank you. All glory to you. Yeah.